This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. To support the production of content like this, donate at cbf.com.au.
My name is Nicholas. My co-host is also named Nicholas. We're going to shake things up this week. We've been talking about mental health in the queer community, so we wanted to bring you something a little bit different. Queer Stories is a live show and podcast that gives our community a chance to perform their stories live. Run by comedian and writer Maeve Marsden, they've now been turned into a book and a podcast.
This story is by Jacob Thomas. Jacob is a 29-year-old non-binary person living in Melbourne and uses the pronouns they, them. In 2016, Jacob was one of two Australians to receive the Queen's Young Leaders Award for their work in suicide prevention and creating accessible pathways for queer people.
Jacob Sitz is the interim coordinator of the Commonwealth Youth Gender and Equality Network and has represented the network at international levels, such as the 61st session of the UN Women's Commission on the Status of Women and the ECOSOC Youth Forum in New York, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, the 11th Commonwealth Youth Forum in London, and at the AIDS 2018 in Amsterdam. Here's Jacob Thomas's story, An Ode to Keith.
An ode to Keith, aka old mate. July 26, 2017, 9:32 a.m. I receive a message from Matthew Wade, editor of Star Observer. The message reads, "Hi Jacob! Exclamation point. I hope you're well. For the next issue of Star Observer, we're having a youth-themed issue and hoping to champion and shine a light on amazing young LGBTI people as well as the issues facing them. I was wondering if you might be interested in being our guest writer for the month. Let me know if you're interested, Matt." I love it when people reach out to me to talk or write. It makes me feel warm inside and that I have something that to contribute, something that matters. After some soul searching, calling deep on my courage, thinking, what would Brené Brown do? I shoot back my reply. "Hi, Matt. I've been mulling it over. I'm thinking of doing a piece about trauma and survival stemming from bullying and abandonment. Because who doesn't love a story full of sorrow and trauma with no clear conclusion? What do you think? Jacob." The entire time writing this article, I can't help but get this voice in my head that's just like, "Jacob, oh my goodness, you're going to be known as the trauma queer." And I kind of was. The article ran on September 4th and had a wider impact than I had anticipated. I had people messaging me their own stories, strangers commenting and praising my honesty. I recently found out that a young person I admire ripped out the article from its stapled spine and saved it as a reminder that he too can navigate his traumas. I'm oddly comfortable talking about trauma. It's what I research. It's often a first date conversation, which kind of goes like, "So what's your star sign and who hurt you as a child?" I know, I'm a hoot. And I jokingly swapped the T from referencing my transness to trauma in the shared acronym because sometimes dark humour is how I cope when the world makes me feel small and insignificant. But this story isn't about trauma. It's about the guy who was with me while I wrote it, my old mate Keith. Keith and I have known each other for a very long time. We met one rainy day when I was 9 years old and we've been inseparable ever since. To be honest, I'm not sure if it was raining or not. I remember being inside, lying down on a bed in our friend's home. I remember feeling isolated and detached, as though there was a space of emptiness that sat between my skin and the universe. Keith came into this room and sat on the floral duvet. He stroked my head and wiped away my tears. Softly so, he leaned in and said, "Don't worry, I'm here now." Keith comes to visit me every now and again. Where I go, he tends to follow. He fuels my creativity. He makes me question long-held philosophies about existentialism, purpose, Aristophanes. He sits in my bed when he comes to visit, sometimes joyfully playing around and pinning me to the mattress so that I can't get up. He holds me down, sometimes sitting on my chest and blowing raspberries in my face. I treat it like a game. Roughhousing as though we're children testing our strength. Keith is actually more like a live-in. He isn't exactly a housemate. He's not like a squatter. He doesn't pay rent, but he pays his way through other means. Sometimes Keith is careless, but who isn't? Keith doesn't always know his own strength. Sometimes when I'm trying to get up after he's pinned me down, I have to tell him that that's enough for today. But he doesn't always listen. He isn't trying to hurt me, I say. He just doesn't know when enough is enough. He's a mirror hog in the morning when I'm trying to get ready for work. He stands in my way so that I can't see myself. Instead, he smears the reflection so that all I'm left with is a haphazard guess that I'm still beautiful. He forgets to tell me when someone has called or sent a message, or conversely, he shakes me the second the buzz of my phone ripples through the denim that cover the legs that Keith says he doesn't always like to look at. And sometimes Keith is mean. Every morning when I walk through my train station racing to my connection, Keith jumps on my back and holds me, clenching his arms around my throat. Keith tells me that what I do doesn't matter and isn't important. He takes the fun out of the things that I love. He's a terrible wingman, like the worst. He tells me to date people who have no capacity for love because, according to Keith, at least we'll have something in common. Keith used to tell me that I shouldn't be around anymore. He's stopped doing that now, but it will always be the hardest thing he said to me when we met 19 years ago. Keith goes by many names. He is a chameleon of human existence and a jack of many trades. I call him the big sad when I don't want to say his name. He represents all the things that I'm afraid of: masculinity, power, domination, and subordination. He's every memory of abandonment, hurt, and a reminder of every time I've been harmed. If Keith were to be considered a part of me, rather than something external to me, he would be male, so to represent all of the other men who've hurt me in the name of love or family. And perhaps, oddly, Keith isn't all bad. Keith has helped me in finding parts of myself I didn't think would inspire pride in me or in how others see me. He helped me find music and gave it special meaning. He was there when I cried to Sia. Who hasn't? Reminding me she was an anchor through 2010 when a friend passed away. Keith has inspired creativity through my drag, pushed me to move my body in ways I never considered, and designed costumes that make the most beautiful, meaningful, and perhaps vulnerable parts of my life visible for who anyone that paid a ticket. Keith has, in some maladaptive sense, pushed me into the work I do now and toward the person I wanted to be. He helped me find my authentic self through telling me who I should be. When he made me feel miserable, he also gave me perspective to see others who have their own battles with their own Keiths. Keith is both my ray of sunshine and my darkest cloud. He is everything I've learnt to hate about myself and all that I'm reclaiming as my own. I wouldn't say that I love Keith. Our relationship is far too untenable and fractured to call it love. Perhaps it's admiration I feel, that of his persistence to refuse to let go of me, even when I want him to. Maybe it's being scared of finding out who I am without him, codependent and independent at the same time. Whatever it is that Keith and I have, it will most likely be forever. And unlike the other men in my life that have hurt me, abandoned me, attempted to break me, and some have succeeded, Keith and I both know that this dysfunction is our most functional. We accept what we cannot change about each other and do our best to coexist. Perhaps Keith has taught me to never stay with a man who would treat me the way that he does. Because how my depression treats me is something no person should ever have to experience at the hand of another. Maybe what I mean to say is thanks to my old mate. In being held down for so long, against my will and my want, Keith has helped me understand what it's like to be finally let go. Thank you.
That was Jacob Thomas performing at Queer Stories. If you yourself are suffering from mental health issues, including suicidal thoughts, we please ask that you call Lifeline on 13 11 14, or if you prefer a service that's more queer-focused, you can call Switchboard on 1800 184 527. If you liked that story, you should follow the Queer Stories podcast, buy the Queer Stories book, or go along to one of the live shows hosted by Maeve Marson. Thank you to Jacob and Maeve for letting us play that story. This is The Informer. Karen Field is the CEO of Drummond Street Services, a charity that focuses on providing welfare support to families. Drummond Street runs an annual survey on the health of the LGBTQI+ community called QueerSpace. This year, the survey spoke to 819 people, 20% of whom were carers for a friend or family member, and looked at the proportions of people in various subsets of our community who have accessed mental health services or suffered financial hardship. The Informer spoke to Karen Field about the survey's findings and what they mean for our community.
Generally speaking, every couple of years, QueerSpace throughout the sort of midsummer carnival and all the events, but also via our social media pages, etc., we do a health and wellbeing survey of the LGBTI community. This year, for quite obvious reasons, in a way, we really wanted to focus in not just on health service usage, but in particular have a focus around mental health because of the Royal Commission into Mental Health at the moment. We want to really get some sort of solid data around what was the service level usage in terms of mental health. We know that carers have particular overrepresentation in terms of mental health issues because of the burden, etc., and we wanted some really good data to see if it sat alongside what we see in our QueerSpace kind of clinical program.
What stood out the most about the results this year?
I guess there was a range of things that we were really keen to have an understanding of. What we're seeing in our clinical data for about the last two or three years has been a steady increase, and we've been concerned that a number of people can speak to the kind of psychological distress that a real kind of targeted sort of political football of the LGBTI community more broadly in social commentary and political commentary, etc. Is this actually creating a distress, and therefore why we're seeing increased kind of help seeking, I guess, from the LGBTI community more broadly? So we wanted to have a look at that. We wanted to kind of have a look at some of the things that we know drive poor mental health in terms of, you know, social connectedness and financial hardship and poor experiences and discrimination, prejudice, those sorts of things. Where were people going? And really drill down into not just have seeing the LGBTI community as a homogenous group. We know that, for instance, we have higher rates for certain people within our community belonging to two specific communities. So rather than the kind of one-size-fits-all, who is carrying the burden for mental health? And what the survey was able to show is that carers have higher rates of poor mental health, but health needs more generally. We were also able to see that clearly our trans and gender diverse community, women, queer women, etc., are carrying the kind of higher rates within the community.
Yeah, one of the statistics that kind of leapt out at us was that financial hardship, it was 25% across the board, but trans and gender diverse people were overrepresented, and especially trans women were severely overrepresented in the percentage of them who were experiencing financial hardship. Does that tell us anything about how the job space is treating different kinds of queer people?
Yeah. So when we've lined up the survey results, it mirrors what we see in our clinical services and the data that shows up there. We see trans and gender diverse children and young people at times of having more experience of disrupted schooling and education completion. It shows up in terms of, therefore, that gives you less job opportunities. We see they experience a lot of discrimination, etc., within that. And we know all this is the what part of the problem is that we often silo each one of these issues. So we silo financial hardship and school completion without thinking also about the impact that that has on people's mental health, on their experiencing housing homelessness. And what we're wanting to see is a much better understanding of what we talk about as comorbidity, where each of these things is therefore setting up poor health and well-being outcomes across the whole range of things, and that burden is not shared equally within our community. Queer people of colour, etc., we know also from our clinical data, also have some common experiences. And so if you're a trans woman of colour, you're experiencing one or more, you know, a whole range of these risk factors will be very common.
Do you know how some of these statistics compare to the non-queer population? So if you compared financial hardship, access to mental health services to a non-queer, what the most significant differences would be?
I think we have known for a long time in Australia that marginalised communities more broadly, particularly those who experience discrimination and prejudice, etc., are more highly likely to experience much greater hardship and experience poorer health and well-being than communities that don't experience that disadvantage, multiple levels of kind of disadvantage. The inverse of that is that where we know LGBTIQ people and people of colour, etc., don't experience discrimination, we also know that they have far less of those problems. So having a family, a supportive family, we know can be hugely protective for a trans and gender diverse child or young people, even in the face of, you know, what we see now in the community around the kind of social commentary around gender identity, etc., and the politicisation of that. It's not like we don't know these things. We know there's an overrepresentation of trans and gender diverse people within housing homelessness compared to cisgender peers more broadly. Housing homelessness, poor outcomes in terms of education, employment, you know, mental health, a whole range of things. So we have that data there. But when you see in very stark terms the multiple ways in which people experiencing and the linkage between those things around psychological distress and poor mental health.
So we need to think of it more intersectionally, maybe? I don't know if that's the correct
word. That's exactly right. Yeah, I think the kind of siloing of health issues can be really unhelpful. And so when we talk about LGBTIQ health and well-being, you can't talk about, say, mental health without talking about discrimination, without talking about that leading to quite extreme levels of financial hardship or social isolation or those sorts of things. And therefore, the kind of program responses and the challenges for us, say, even with the Royal Commission into Mental Health, is to think, yes, there's a whole range of things that have to happen universally. What we do know is the LGBTI community are accessing LGBTI services, both ourselves and Thorn Harbour. The only mental health funding we have is a very small amount from the federal government of all places in terms of mental health kind of clinical dollars. And what we do know from communities that experience a lot of kind of discrimination and disadvantages and experiencing that within the health system is that we need to have targeted responses and build those responses where communities go. And I know both, particularly Queer Space, for instance, has now 5 months wait list. You know, we double clinical load every year and we can't meet the demands that there. And I'm absolutely sure that Thorn Harbour would be experiencing the same thing. So then when you're thinking about public policy and responding to the communities that are overburdened with these health risk issues, then those services need to be built where those communities feel safe to go. And I think that's a really important thing in the kind of debate that is often about mainstreaming. Good public health shows you build your best service responses that already have that engagement.
That was Karen Field, the CEO of Drummond Street Services.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.